Entering the midterm home stretch, we are going to pull out an oldie but a goodie. The economy, stupid. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is 16th of August today. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are, as of this airing, 81 days from the 2018 midterm elections. Unemployment's low. The stock market, while not being the economy, hello, is doing all right. Corporate profits are strong, and the general economic mood is favorable. Those being the conditions, the party in power would seem to be in pretty good shape, right? Marketplace's Kimberly Adams, Truth Squad's That Received Political Wisdom.
There's a reason politicians like to talk about the economy. People say it's really important when they're deciding how to vote. Mark Weisbrot is with the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
For swing voters, for example, they may not be paying close attention to a lot of other issues, but they'll know how the economy's doing.
But when things are going well in the economy, people start caring more about other issues, like immigration. Jonathan Rothwell at Gallup says that's showing up in polling.
We have seen that economic issues have fallen somewhat relative to some of the other issues that people tend to mention.
Only 14% of Americans in a recent Gallup poll think the economy is the top issue in the country, fewer than those worried about, say, bad leadership in Washington. Another thing overshadowing the economy? President Trump. John Sides is a political science professor at George Washington University.
The president remains less popular than you would predict based on unemployment and growth in the economy more generally.
Sides says midterm elections are usually a referendum on the president. And
the president himself, in some sense, can't get out of his own way and let the economy help him and help his party.
He says it's hard for the GOP to focus on the good economy when tweets, tapes, and investigations dominate the news. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
All right, totally different direction now. There is big news in agriculture today. Scientists have sequenced the genome for wheat, which is a big deal because the wheat genome is apparently a beast, just genetically, like, big. So it's a great science story, but it's got huge economic implications as well. Think crops and food and feeding a hungry planet. Marketplace's Jed Kim has that one.
Wheat is the most widely planted cereal crop, providing about a fifth of the calories humans eat. But while our population is growing, land isn't. John Fellers is a wheat molecular biologist for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
We're just trying to feed the population that is facing us, and we've got to be able to improve the way that we increase the yield potential of these lines.
Plants that'll use less water, grow more product, or tolerate saltier soils. Developing new wheat takes time, however, usually more than 10 years. Having a mapped sequence could cut in half how long it takes to get the commodity to market, and it can make the crop more attractive. Since the early 2000s, many farmers have ditched wheat to grow better moneymakers like corn. Kelly Eversole is executive director of the international group that did the sequencing.
There's not been any profitability from an industry standpoint in wheat because there were not these advanced tools.
The sequenced genome will also speed development of genetically modified wheat, but global resistance to GMOs may put a check on that kind of investment. Jason Lusk teaches agricultural economics at Purdue.
There is worry about how our trading partners may respond and whether they'll accept wheat that's been produced with some of these technologies.
Right now, there are no commercial lines of GMO wheat on the market. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Remember how I said yesterday to ignore the big fall in the stock market? So look, if you're going to do that on a big down day, you got to do it on a big up day too, gang. It's only fair. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Turkish lira did all right today, got a little bit stronger against the dollar, but its long decline over time, the lira has lost 60% of its value just this year, has not only shaken global markets, it's also rattled businesses inside Turkey, including a lot of businesses owned by Syrian refugees. Since 2011, more than 3.5 million Syrians have crossed the border into Turkey to get away from the civil war in their country. And Syrians are now almost 5% of the Turkish population. And even in the best of times, it can take years for immigrant groups to integrate into a new economy. So a lot of those Syrians are just now starting to get a foothold. but it's a foothold that could slip right along with the lira. Marketplace's Rima Kreis was in Turkey just before the latest currency crisis and brought back this story of two young Syrian entrepreneurs.
Before the civil war broke out in Syria, 34-year-old Dania Abdelbaki had a good job in a nice, quiet office, drafting blueprints and solving problems. She tells me in Arabic that for 5 years she worked as a civil engineer, designing mostly commercial buildings in Hama, Syria. But today, as a refugee in Turkey, her work, well, it is not quiet. For starters, this is what it sounds like when someone's at the door. And once you step inside...
Head, shoulders, knees and toes, knees and toes.
Kids, lots of them. This is Wonder World, the daycare Abdelbaki opened 2 years ago in Gaziantep, one of Turkey's biggest cities. Abdelbaki moves through the brightly painted playroom, retying messy ponytails and wiping runny noses. This is not what she expected to be doing with her life. My dream, she says, was to stay in the engineering field. From day one, I loved engineering. But like many Syrian refugees with professional degrees, she couldn't get a job in her field here, where the rules and language are different. Eventually, Abdelbaki gave up and started taking classes. That meant putting her two boys in daycare for the first time.
It was our first experience to put our kids at some foreigner place.
That's Abdelbaki's husband, Ahmed Bushi. He's also a former engineer, now working at a Syrian nonprofit. He says when he called the daycare to check up on their kids, no one answered. Not a good sign. I was very worried about them, Abdelbaki says. I didn't feel a sense of security. And that was her aha moment. She and Bushi decided they would open their own daycare in Gaziantep, where one out of every four people is from Syria. The streets are lined with Syrian-owned shawarma restaurants, groceries, and other businesses that have sprung up to cater to the growing refugee community. For Abdelbaki, things quickly got complicated. She found out that Turkey doesn't allow refugees to open schools or daycares. But she could register the business as a children's library, so she did. Then they needed money. They turned to family and friends.
You ask them to believe in you, to invest their money with you. So it was this one challenging that we have it. It was hard for us.
But they pulled together $20,000, bought an old Turkish restaurant, and Abdelbaki got to work, transforming it into Wonder World. She obsessed over every detail, especially when it came to the bridge, Abdelbaki's masterwork of engineering at the entry to the daycare. She explains how she spent months getting the dimensions just right, making sure the slats on the railing were close enough so little heads couldn't get stuck, and the curve was steep enough to keep tiny kids from heading out the door. Finally, opening day. Only one family showed up. Her husband immediately hit the streets, stopping every mom and child he could, pointing in the direction of the new daycare. Abdelbaki thought discounts were the answer. She drove Bucci nuts with the idea.
Can I make a discount? Can I make a discount? No. No way to give a good discount.
It took a while, but word got around. And now, 2 years later, there are 40 families at Wonder World, most of them Syrian. Still, Bucci says the business barely makes a profit, and the lira crisis could wipe that out. They pay their rent in euros. So the more the lira depreciates, the higher the rent goes. They may have to move. But at the moment, Abdelbaki's main concern is keeping a crowd of toddlers occupied, including her son.
My name is Bessa.
And how old are you?
5, thank you.
Fine, thank you, he says. He thought I was asking him how he's doing. He's 7 years old, and his brother is 4. Abdelbaki says her children and the ones she looks after may never know Syria the way she did, so she teaches them a song. My land has been set on fire, they sing. Give us peace. Give us our childhood. In Gaziantep, Turkey, I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
We should tell you that Rima's reporting was made possible for us by the International Center for Journalists, their Bringing Home the World Fellowship. Democratic voters in Vermont made history this week, nominating Christine Hallquist as the first transgender major party gubernatorial candidate in the country. Hallquist is just one of a number of trans people making their voices heard this year, whether it's in politics, on a TV show, or at work. And I'm using voice here in the literal sense. Thomas Page McBee, he's an author and a journalist who transitioned when he was 30, so after he'd had a couple of jobs. He had a piece in the New York Times last week about the power of his changed voice in the office. And I asked him when we talked, when he first realized what was going on.
I had just started a new job at the Boston Phoenix, and it was in a new newsroom. I was pretty low on the totem pole, and I'd really only been on testosterone for a few months, but it had worked pretty quickly on my body. I was just noticing, like, sort of very rapidly a lot of changes about, you know, not just how I looked physically, but the way I was being treated in the world. And one place that was really clear was at work, you know, an editorial meeting where people are sort of talking over each other and having a lot of thoughts. And in my past life, you know, before my transition, I had really been careful about when to speak and how much to speak. And it was a lot of mental energy to figure out how to be assertive and make myself heard. And I noticed this just because it was such a dissonance. But when I sort of gathered the courage to say something in this meeting, everyone got silent very quickly. Hmm. And that was the first time that it ever happened to me.
People paid attention.
Yeah, exactly.
Did it change? Did this realization, did it change how you use your voice in the workplace?
It did eventually. I mean, at that time, it was such a whirlwind of other changes. As my life moved on and I was able to sort of more and more at work, especially like the ease in which I was able to do things that I hadn't found any ease at all with, like, for example, promotions or negotiating pay, or just even, you know, the rise I had in stature so quickly, I realized, like, over time that there was no way to avoid the reality that I was benefiting from being a man.
Did your female coworkers start treating you differently, or what did you notice about how your female coworkers were treating you, I guess is a better question?
What I noticed was that if a bunch of women I worked with were talking and I came up and contributed to the conversation in the way I was socialized to do so, which is through interrupting, everyone would get silent. And, you know, that was for me like the moment where I realized, oh, this is a weapon. You know, this isn't just this isn't a tool anymore. My voice, I mean, I'm creating an environment for people, whether or not any of us are conscious of it, where I'm making other people small.
And you started keeping track of your own behavior, right? I mean, who you, like, responded to on emails and whose opinion you pushed back on. There was a bunch of stuff that you itemized, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, what I decided to do about it eventually was really to look at myself and my own behavior and to start tracking what I was doing. So I started paying attention to how often I interrupted women versus men, how often I took men more seriously. And I was horrified by the way I'd internalized this socialization that really started when I was 30 years old. So what I started to do was ask the women in my life, like, what sort of feedback would they give me, you know, and what can I do to make your life easier, to make room for you? Once I started doing that in earnest and taking those suggestions, things changed really quickly for me at work.
Yeah. On the flip side of that question, though, you talk about how men started treating you differently, right? People giving you the deferential sir and all that?
Yeah. I mean, I think being in the world as a man is incredibly different because your right to be in space is never questioned and, in fact, is like upheld all the time. And the better you perform that masculinity, the more deference you're given. So, of course, there's an incentive to keep behaving in ways that are maybe pretty problematic because that's what power is. But I think making gender visible is a positive thing, especially in this cultural moment we're all living through. So I think the ability to sort of see and name, you know, that this is happening, I hope, is useful to people who are not just trans, but like of all genders, because most of this sort of thing is so unconscious that we don't even see it.
Thomas Page McBee, he's a journalist, a writer, as well. His most recent book is called Amateur, A True Story About What Makes a Man. Thomas, thanks a lot. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Coming up.
I am sweating, and I am a cold person normally, and I am like, there is something wrong.
Turn up the AC and also the price tag. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, here you go. 396 to the upside for the Dow Jones Industrial Average today. 1.5% closed at 25,558. NASDAQ up 32 points, 0.4%, 78.06. The S&P 500 gained 22 points, 0.7%, 28.40. Some drug makers dipped today after President Trump said he was considering ordering legal action against pharmaceutical companies over the opioid epidemic. Assertio Therapeutics off 9.4% today. Endo International weakened about 0.6%. Walmart stacked up 9.3% today after posting its best quarterly sales growth in the U.S. for a decade. Particularly strong in online and grocery sales, in case you want to read the fine print. Retail rival Amazon up 0.2%. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.86%. You're listening to Marketplace. We heard from Catherine in Bellingham, Washington the other day, who says she finds great value in how Marketplace explains things like tax reform and how changing fiscal policy affects our lives. If you agree with Catherine, please join her by donating online at marketplace.org. And thanks to Catherine and all the Marketplace investors who make our work possible. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Used to be, if somebody said the big three in a corporate sense, they were talking about Ford, GM, and Chrysler, Detroit's big three car makers. We, right now, are in a digital economy, and we are talking video game consoles at the moment, where the big three are Nintendo, Sony, and Microsoft. We're talking video game consoles at the moment and the possible demise thereof, because Haley Tsukiyama wrote about them the other day in the Washington Post. Haley, it's good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
So let me lean right in to the headline, the title on this piece. How close are we to the end of the gaming console anyway?
Well, we have a lot of people making promises about how we're going to move past the box, but really we're not as close as I think a lot of people would like us to be.
Well, let's break it down a little bit. First of all, what is the current state of gaming consoles today? I mean, A, they're expensive, and B, companies make money from these things.
Yes, absolutely. So we have pretty much three major console makers, right? We have Microsoft with their Xbox, we have Sony with the PlayStation, and we have Nintendo, which has had sort of a surprise hit with a new console that they're calling the Switch, which you can take kind of with you as you go, or you can set it up in your living room. As you say, these are expensive, especially if you are looking at some of the high-end boxes. You know, we're talking $700-$800, so it's definitely an investment. I think you're seeing people going, well, look, I can watch movies wherever I want. I can listen to music wherever I want. Why can't I play whatever game I want wherever I want?
There is an infrastructure thing that comes with that, though, right? Because you have to stream all that content, and not everybody has broadband, not everybody has mobile, not everybody has the support in place to be able to do this.
Absolutely. So that's the huge technical aspect that we have to overcome. You know, if you look at something like a game, you really have to have a lot of computing power, right? You need to be able to not only make sure that, you know, when I move my hand on my game to hit someone with something, that they can react. And you're absolutely right. You know, a lot of the broadband and mobile networks are not up for that. And, you may not mind a hiccup in your Netflix stream, but if you have a problem in a game, that could be your digital life or death.
Yeah. Is this something gamers are craving? I mean, do they want to get away from the console and the set-top box, as it were?
I think there is some of that. You know, for one, there's a lot more people playing games than we've had in the past. And because it's becoming a more mainstream thing, we're seeing people want to be a little more social. They want to play together. They want to hang out and play together, which is something that, you know, we haven't had as much of really in the past several years.
Are you thinking this is going to be, so this is a business model question. Are you thinking it's going to be a subscription service? Do you pay like a one-time fee? How does this work?
You know, I think if you are, you know, Sony, Microsoft, Nintendo, ideally what happens for you is that you become like the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store of games, or you become the Netflix of games, and, you know, they kind of have a catalog to choose from. But if you're a publisher, that's actually not a great model, because it's hard for them to get visibility and to make sure that people are actually playing their game.
Is there since you mentioned it a couple of times now, actually, is there a Netflix of gaming on the horizon, do you think?
Well, so we have seen some people try this. Notably, there's a company called Gamefly where you can get discs or you can do some streaming. I think for consumers, you have to subscribe to a different service for every publisher. That's not a great model. There are some technicalities as well as some just, you know, appeal things to work out.
Yeah, but consumers are ready for those different subscriptions, right? Because I have to do HBO to get Game of Thrones, but I have to do Netflix to get, House of Cards.
Yeah, I mean, that is a good point. I think Games are more social, I would say. Huh. Like, you can watch a TV show and have that subscription service and then talk about it with your friends later. If you're looking at a game, you got to make sure that all your friends are on the same service, that your things are all compatible. So it is a little more difficult.
No, it makes total sense. Haley Tsukiyama writes at the Washington Post most recently about the end of the gaming console, maybe, kind of, sort of. Haley, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
The forecast high in Austin, Texas today, according to the Weather Channel, was 99 degrees with 34% humidity, which puts the heat index at really hot. And if you live there and you don't have AC or your AC's broken, this is about the worst time you can imagine to have to replace or repair or get a new AC system installed. Those installation companies know they have the pricing upper hand right now, but this summer there are some other things to consider. Higher prices in response to President Trump's tariffs on imported steel and aluminum. Marketplace's Andy Euler reports on how that's playing out in the sweltering heat of Austin.
In Texas, this is one of the most comforting sounds in the summer. The sweet hum of air conditioning cooling down a sweltering house. Caitlin Leahy and her husband own this house. She came home recently with her daughters, aged 2 and 5, to find her AC unit giving plenty of sound, but no cooling.
I'm getting the girls situated and making dinner, and I am sweating, and I am a cold person normally, and I am like, there is something wrong.
There was something wrong. The Leahy's HVAC unit was about 20 years old and needed to be replaced. In this heat, she wasted no time.
We had people come to the house Tuesday and Wednesday, and we made our decision Wednesday, and they installed it Friday, and that week was the longest week of my life. It was so hot.
She did some shopping around, looking at prices and reading reviews, but she says with the thermometer rising, she was under pressure, didn't have as much time to ask as many questions as she wanted. Among those, questions about tariffs, even though she knew it could be a factor.
I feel like our situation this summer, it was really a timing issue, more so than we were worried about tariffs.
But other people are worried about them. Eric Love owns Trufficient Energy Solutions in Texas. His company doesn't make AC units, it just installs them in homes. He didn't install Leahy's unit, but he says he's surprised by the number of customers who worry U.S. trade policy might be pushing up prices.
Believe it or not, consumers are actually pretty aware of what was going on because some of them would ask about the equipment before we even reached the price, whether that would affect the pricing or not.
Love says back in March, when the first round of tariffs on steel and aluminum went into place, HVAC manufacturers started reaching out to installers.
Certain manufacturers, they sent out letters saying there's going to be price increases.
Like this message posted on the website of Hercules Industries, a major HVAC manufacturer.
Since the announcement of a 25% tariff on all foreign steel imports, the market has been placed under significant constraints unlike which we have experienced in recent past. To navigate such volatile market conditions, we will be implementing a 6% increase on all non-material intensive products and a 12% increase on material intensive products.
And the company warns it's not ruling out more price hikes in the future. When manufacturers do that, installers like Eric Love have to either absorb the price hike themselves or pass it on to their customers.
Every company does their pricing different. Every company has a different overhead. My philosophy has been just be pretty open with customers.
Most of his business comes from word of mouth and referrals, so he's got an extra incentive not to push up his prices. But he also says record heat across the country this summer has meant he's been busier than in the past. So now he can keep up his profits by installing more units to hopefully make up for the rise in cost.
Unfortunately, I have no control over pricing for manufacturers or what's going on politically, but even with the price increases, this has been a great year for, I think, most HVAC companies.
Caitlin Leahy says she's happy to pick up whatever price increases the tariffs may have added to her new HVAC unit. She says she's lucky to be able to afford to replace things when they break down. And she likes helping people, like her installer, make a living.
These people are trying to get by. They're working so hard to keep their business at a certain profit margin. And for me, that extra couple hundred dollars that maybe was passed on to me, I kind of don't mind it because that to me is a way to support that small business.
She just hopes her family's not going to have to help any more small HVAC installation businesses for at least another 20 years. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
final note on the way out today, circling back to the piece Kimberly Adams did yesterday for us about the dollar as the global reserve currency and how that helps the American economy. As it happens, the president's chief economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, was on CNBC talking about how strong the dollar has been of late.
I think that the king dollar, the strong dollar, it's a steady dollar, is a sign of confidence. Okay? There's a lot of unrest around the world. Money's flowing into the USA. That's terrific.
All of which is totally true. It's also true, though, that a strong dollar makes American exports more expensive for buyers overseas, as do retaliatory trade tariffs. The global economy, once again, is not a zero-sum game, gang. All right, we cut it a little close today, so let's just say Wall Street was up, shall we? John Buckley, Eve Epstein, Stephen Gregory, John Gordon, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.